Hey, this is DJ Hop, and you're listening to Rebel Radio with my man Josh Levine. Fuck you, Josh.
What's up? This is Rebel Radio.
What up? What up? This is DJ Newmark.
This is Peanut Butter Wolf.
It's your boy. It's okay.
Keep checking out Rebel Radio.
Rebel Radio.
This is Rebel Radio.
We're in the place right here. Rebel Radio is going down.
Would you say Rebel Radio?
Oh, wait. Let's do it again.
Rebel Radio.
Hey, what up? Welcome back. It's Rebel Radio. I'm your host, Josh Levine. We're here today with my man, DJ Hoppa, the director of the Scratch DJ Academy. He's the founder of the Feeling Good Sound. Look for his Feeling Good records out there. You've seen him as a DJ on KTLA News here in Los Angeles. You might have seen him in Fast and Furious 7. He's the host of Music Mornings on Dash Radio. This dude is busy. He took a few minutes out to give us a little time on the mic. He tells some great stories. In fact, so much so that we're cutting this episode into two parts. So we don't do that very often, but whenever we get a guest that has so much information for you, we don't want to give it to you all at once. We stretch it out. So check it. Part one is today. He's going to tell us how he got inspired originally making Pause mixtapes in San Francisco. And then seeing Q-Bert and the Invisible Scratch Pickles play live really kind of opened his eyes to the world of DJing. He's going to give us a little bit of his history with the DJ crew and how his boldness and his willingness to get on the mic when none of his partners would do that created opportunity for him. And he's going to tell us about kind of being what he calls bilingual, understanding both the business side and the creative side of this culture that we're in. Good stuff here coming up on Rebel Radio with DJ Hoppa right after our EDM.com track of the week.
You keep telling me I'm a victim of your lies. You don't even hear my cries. You keep telling me I'm a victim of your lies. You don't even hear my cries.
Track. I hope you liked it. That was Audiobot and Bamiya with a track called Lies, our EDM.com track of the week. And now let's hear from DJ Hoppa.
Okay, so cool.
Let's start rolling. But sure, I'm excited to have you on. I know I know you're a man of many talents. And as I've been doing some research, learning about all kind of stuff that I didn't even know about.
Right. It's like an onion.
Yeah,
peeling
exactly.
Back the layers.
Exactly. From being DJing on the news, which I never even thought of. That's a pretty amazing job for a DJ.
Yeah.
To Fast and Furious 7. They're like, dude, you're everywhere.
It's happened so organically as well, you know, and it all stems from the DJ side of things. And I think to me, you know, this could potentially be an Achilles heel, but I'm so fascinated with different aspects of our sort of world of entertainment, you know, that I really haven't had this focused, you know, I only do this.
Right.
And the reason why I say it could be an Achilles heel is, you know, certainly I feel like there's friends of mine who have just done this and have done really well and kind of carved a niche out for what it is that they do. And I think for me, I just don't know. It never satisfied me to just be a DJ.
I mean, I think the stories that we're hearing on this show is like, there's a lot of both.
Right.
There's certain people that they just want to do one thing. They want to do it over and over.
Right.
That works for them. And there's other people that, you know, they need to have their hands in a whole bunch of different things. I think, like you said, there's trade-offs.
Yeah, for sure.
But so I definitely want to dig into that a little bit, but I want to hear kind of how it all began. I know you're from San Francisco like I am.
Yeah, man.
I didn't realize you went to Wash, so.
Oh, did you go to Wash?
I went to McAteer.
Oh, okay.
I'm a lot older, but.
Okay. You're not that much older than
but
me.
But they were kind of the two rival
yes.
schools. I don't know if they were when you were there.
We have rivalries with different schools for different sports or different things, you know. But, Wash, I grew up in the Richmond District in San Francisco, so in the Avenues. And so Wash was, four blocks from my house.
Yeah.
I think growing up in San Francisco, I'm third generation San Franciscan. So, I mean, by being in the city, man, my dad was pissed that I decided to go to L.A. There's this definite, not even a love-hate relationship between San Francisco and L.A. There's just this hate-hate relationship between San Francisco and L.A.
Really on the San Francisco side.
Absolutely on the San Francisco
LA,
side.
I think L.A., we don't really care. We're just like, we're doing our thing.
There's not as much hometown pride, I think, here in L.A. as there is in San Francisco. And I don't mean that as a knock to anybody who's from L.A., but... LA is definitely this like melting pot of people from different places, which San Francisco has turned into that too with the tech boom and all of that. But I think, for me, it started with this fascination with, recording things from the radio on cassette tapes and then trying to make something creative out of that. And so, starting with the pause tapes and then I started to get into shorter format, so like taking a cassette single, putting scotch tape over the holes on the top of it so that I could record over it. It would be a much shorter, so I wouldn't waste the tape, but instead would like recycle some whatever, some Debbie Deb single or something like that that I just wanted to re-record over and make like a Pac and Far Side mashup of some kind and make like a single version of it.
So, you're talking about this, and I remember those days with the dubbing deck and all that stuff. And, but people don't realize we had Chalk on the show last week, and we were talking
about... Oh, really? Okay.
We were talking about sort of the same topic, how easy shit is now compared to, how crazy difficult it was to do interesting stuff. I mean, you figured it out, but it was like...
I think
so much work.
And I think, I'm really glad that I came up in that era. I'm sure we'll get into this, but, I have the pleasure of working with a lot of people that are just starting off with the creative side and getting into DJing and through all sort of the work that I do with the education side. But I would agree with you to some extent. And I think that, in some ways it was also a lot simpler. Mm-hmm. And in some ways it was... a more linear path. So for me, I started with the cassettes, and then I remember my best friend's older brother was into DJing and actually had a set of turntables, and he never let us even in his room.
Right.
So I mean, I never might as well have been in another country. But I remember one day after school, we were working on one of these little tapes that my buddy Mike and I were working on, and his older brother was like, "You guys don't even know what you're doing. You don't even know what DJing is, man." And we were like, "Well, okay, so tell us."
Right.
And he wouldn't. And all he did was he just gave us a flyer to go and see the Invisible Scratch Pickles at the D. Young Museum after school one day. And I had no idea who these dudes were. I was looking at the flyer they don't even spell pickles right, what am I going to learn from these dudes? And it was after school at the De Young. We went there anyways. And we're like, yeah, sure, fine, we'll go there. And you know where the De Young Museum is. It's not far from my parents' house, went there after school. And I remember, man, it was a room full of maybe 20 people. Maybe. I mean, including them, it was 20 people. Mm-hmm. And, they had their rigs set up and, three turntables, three mixers. I was looking at this, okay, what are these guys going to do? And then they start playing and, man, they, we're doing these routines, really utilizing the turntable as an instrument, somebody playing, the drums, somebody playing a lead line, a horn. I was just wow, this is crazy. They're a band using turntables. And I was my dad has one of those. Mm-hmm. I was come on, let's go back to my parents' house. We started taking out Stevie Wonder records. We started taking out Earth, Wind & Fire records and trying to cut it up on my dad's like phonograph, you know, turn like in the whole, you know, entertainment system thing.
Yeah.
And that obviously didn't work very well.
It doesn't work the same.
And then we figured out that, oh, you needed to have special turntables, special needles. And so that really is the, I think, the start of my journey. And, you know, we saved up for a DJ in a box. You know, mail ordered it. There was no internet, obviously, then. Right. Mail ordered it. And, you know, from there, man, just got into really this fascination with digging for records and, like, going to the record store. And I just fell in love with this... with that process and that sort of like the cultural side of it, of just like being in the record store and there being a dude that you're like kind of intimidated by. And, you know, you would see other DJs that like, you know, clearly they knew what they were doing. And like, it was very much a learning process and sort of a rite of passage in a lot of ways, you know? And I think like over the years, man, I mean, I've just, you know, just got deeper into it and just made great friends over the years, you know, and that part has been really cool.
Funny you say that, because I, you know, I came down here for college and I used to go to Prime Cuts on Santa Monica Boulevard, and like, and that was my main spot. And then Doc Martin started working there, and you know, he was a big DJ in San Francisco that I didn't know him, but I knew of him,
right?
And it was like, yeah, I was like, oh shit, that's Doc Martin. Like, am I gonna go ask him about a record? Like, there was a moment, I mean, I did, and then he was cool, and we became, you know, I'd see him every few weeks or whatever, and we, you know, we had a little rapport, but yeah, there's that moment where it is kind of intimidating, and all that. So, but going back even to the city, like, what music were you, what was the first music that really impacted you?
So I think, I mean, there's been, you know, evolutions in my journey through music, as there is with most people. And I think, for me, man, I mean, the Chronic album did wonders for me. And like, I was just so obsessed with that. I mean, before that, you know, I was listening to a lot of pop stuff, like, you know, was a fan of Michael Jackson and like all of those records. But, you know, I think listening to the Chronic album, which was, you know, sort of taboo at the time, and just like, you know, was, I know my parents weren't pleased with me listening to the Chronic album, you know, and for me though, listening to that versus like the Boys to Men records that I was listening to before that was just really eye opening. And
do you remember the first record you ever bought?
The first like 12-inch or the first like album I ever bought? I mean, one of the first albums that I actually bought that wasn't from like my dad's collection, because that's kind of how I started. I was like taking like, you know, some of the stuff that we had as kids, like Sesame Street records and like, you know, Alvin and the Chipmunks Christmas records, and like trying to do something with it, you know. But one of the first albums that, or like sort of EPs that I bought, was the Far Side EP that had Run In, Drop, like on it, you know, and it had an instrumental side. I still have that record somewhere. But that was one of the first records that I remember, you know, actually physically buying. Another one, this is, you know, it is what it is, man. Like, I remember going to, what was it? I think it was called Zebra Records in San Francisco. And I bought, this had a different fascination for me. I bought a Janet Jackson, I Get So Lonely, 12-inch that had house remixes on it.
Yeah.
And for me, that was a really interesting thing. And now looking back on it, now being a remixer, now being like a producer on that end and making like, you know, taking something that, you know, like making a different version of something. And now kind of coming full circle and realizing like how sort of impactful that record was for me. Like, you know, Janet Jackson, that song was like a ballad and was like a real, like a bedroom record, you know, and then to be able to... listen to these remixes. I don't even remember who the remixers were. I still have that record somewhere too, but you know, that definitely had an impact also of this idea of like not just leaving it and keeping it in the same vein, but being able to sort of take it wherever you want and reach a different audience. So yeah, I mean, one of the first things that I remember doing even as a DJ was like taking, it was the same trip to the record store. I got the Janet Jackson, I Get So Lonely remix record. And I also got a Panay record. It was a Filipino act from the Bay.
Okay.
That was being played at the time, and they were like a dance, like almost like the 90s version of freestyle, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
So that like 90s wave of like Bay Area freestyle,
yeah,
which I was a fan of at the time. And like, I remember those two records, that was actually kind of like my first blend. Those were the first two tracks I were able to really get like matched up together BPM wise and tempo wise and be able to mix those two together. So
what was that record?
God, what was that Panay record? It had a silver label. I got it at the house. It was funny, man. Recently, I had Jocelyn Enriquez on my radio show.
Okay.
And we were talking about some of like that era. I got to go back and find that. I forget the name of it. They only really had like, you know, two singles that really did it. So it's got to be, it's pretty easy, I think, to go back and figure that out.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, that was so kind of my first journey into it. And then, you know, actually things coming back full circle too. Like, I remember, you know, I hated what my dad listened to growing up. Like, it was just, he constantly, like, he had Hall and Oates playing in the car and just like, I mean, even Stevie Wonder at the time, like, I wasn't like a fan of that. Or like Bob James, my dad was playing that and was never a fan of it until later on, you know, diving deeper into hip hop. And then from there, then going back to them, these samples, and being like, oh man, I remember Rich Girl, you know, like this reminds
like
me of my
dad.
Yeah. And
that's
like,
funny.
And then years later raiding his record collection. And I remember going up for the holidays one year when I was in college and just being like, Dad, I'm just going to, if you don't mind, you don't even use these records. You don't even listen to them anymore. I'm just going to take them and I'll record them for you.
Yeah.
And I'll send you like the MP3s of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah,
so
man, it's been a journey. It's been a journey for sure.
Hey, check it out. Rebel Radio is brought to you by Wix.com. Do you need a website? No, let me tell you, you do need a website, and you can do it yourself with Wix.com. No matter what business you're in, if you got a startup, your music career, your earwax collection, I don't know what you're doing. Whatever it is, you need a website. And Wix is used by more than 84 million people worldwide. It makes it easy to get your website live today. You can spend time on your business. Don't spend time building your website. There's hundreds of designer-made templates to choose from. Use the drag-and-drop editor. You drop in your images, your videos, your copy. And next thing you know, you have a beautiful website that you built yourself. It's fast. It's easy. It's free. We did it with rebelradio.net. Check it out. And you can see the amazing work you can do with Wix.com. You're too busy with everything else? Stop worrying about your website. Wix.com, it's easy and free. Go to Wix.com. Create your own website today. Send it to us, and we will promote it online. All right. So, you know, you talk about going to see the Pickles. And it's funny where I think, you know, DJing has... where it's gone. I'm curious your thought on what the legacy or the impact that Q-Bert has had. And all those guys, but Q's kind of, you know, to me, the one that, like, revolutionized DJing.
Total. I mean, there's a lot of guys that absolutely have, like, left their, you know, their mark and have put their stamp on it. And, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, one day, I mean, I know myself, I'm not going to be regarded in that way, but sort of that I'll leave a legacy in a different sort of way. And that's always been a goal of mine, you know, since I started teaching, was to really, like, leave this legacy. And not to take a detour, but, you know, we talk about Kool Herc in our classroom, and I've had the opportunity to work with Herc and to spend some time with him. Total sidebar, man, but this will sound like a make-believe story, but I was in the Bronx and went to go visit Herc and I had no idea how it would go down. Like, we had met before then, but I had never spent like a full day with him. And so he was like, yeah, sure, come up to the Bronx. I mean, it literally took me like freaking 3 hours to find him because the directions that he gave me were so like all over the place. I mean, like, he's like one of those dudes who's just like, yeah, there's a White Castle on the corner, and on the other corner, there's a CVS. Like, meet me there.
Right.
Yo, like, okay. And he gave me the street, but it was like the streets were wrong and like, yeah, whatever. Ended up meeting up with him. We get in his van and we drive to this like outdoor park area, and he wanted to fly kites. I can't even make this up, man. He had this giant kite strapped to the top of his van. And wow, like, that's what he wanted to fly. And he made it himself. He made this kite himself.
That's incredible.
And we're out there flying kites and just chopping it up, man. But like, so the reason why I say this, though, is like, I feel like in our world, there's a lot of these guys that are like heroes, mm-hmm, within our own little world that we have that aren't necessarily household names. And that, like, when I look at Herc and I look at, like, his legacy and what he has, you know, material-wise, or just, like, what he just even has accomplished versus what the public knows about him, like, there's this huge disparity. And I feel the same about Q, you know? Like, I feel like every DJ knows who Q-Bert is and looks at him like, man, like, that dude is, like, the guy. And yet, like, more people know, obviously, who Calvin Harris is, mm-hmm, than they would who Q-Bert is, sure, you know? And to me, like, I don't necessarily, that's no knock to Calvin Harris in any which way. And I'm like, I'm a Calvin Harris fan, man. I love what he's done for the, you know, for the culture as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I find it, you know, with, when it comes to Q, his impact that he's left, and this idea of innovation is like next level. And I'm really excited for some of the stuff that they're doing with Intel right now. I'm really excited for, you know, just where his head is at too. We, you know, funny enough, this kind of comes full circle with us talking about those two guys. We honored Kool Herc, Q-Bert, and A-Track all on one night in New York one night for our 10-year anniversary of Scratch.
Oh, cool.
And to have those three in the room together was really fascinating.
Yeah.
And quick short story about Q, man. I mean, I told you that I went to go see him at the De Young Museum, and we've become friends, you know, in more recent time. We've become friends, and to just even say that Q's a friend of mine is pretty awesome. But we were at the 10-year anniversary. We were there, and he was set to do this little performance. Well, right before he's going on, I mean, I don't know if a lot of people have gotten a chance to see the behind the scenes of Q before he goes on and performs, but I mean, he is a true artist. And, you know, what he does with the turntable is magical. But, you know, he's stretching his fingers for like half an hour.
Is that right?
Before he goes on. I mean, like, and then in terms of just like his mental preparation, you could see him go from like, we're in like hangout mode backstage, to then just like, okay, wait, when, half an hour? Okay, cool. And all of a sudden you saw this like shift, just like you'd see in any sort of pro athlete, where he's just like mentally preparing for that moment. And I mean, it wasn't a big show. I mean, it was our 10-year anniversary, but there, it wasn't like, you know, being broadcast to like, you know, millions of homes or anything like that. But he took that same preparation, and he gets up there, and he starts doing something with this record where I've never seen anybody do this ever before. So he's scratching a sample, right? And then bangs the record with his fist. Bangs the record, and the needle jumps to a different part of the record, which is a different sample.
Right.
And then is scratching that sample. And then he takes his thumb with the bottom end of the record and flips it up like this. And it moves the needle back to the original sample that he was scratching.
Yeah.
And I was just like blown away. And I don't even think like most of the people in the audience really didn't catch that. I'm like standing right next to him, so I'm picking up on that. I was just like blown away. the next morning at breakfast, like, we're just chopping it up, and I'm like, yo, last night you did something that I've never seen anybody do before. And it was explaining what he said. Oh, yeah. Well, when I first got up there, I recognized that the platter wasn't exactly even. Like, what? What are you talking about? I mean, like I used those turntables actually before he did.
Yeah.
I was like, what? And he was like, yeah, so that technique you can only do on a turntable where the platter's not even. Like, wow, dude. I mean, like, in terms of, like, really mastering your craft, that's, like, next level. Yeah. You know what I mean?
What's up? It's DJ Kubert hanging out at Scratch Academy, Miami. Yeah. It feels like we got to invent a turntable and mixers so I could practice in a hotel room. I was so rusty up there. I'm like, ah! You know, it's like, if I miss a day or two, it makes me rusty. Those little teeny imperfections kind of, like, irk me. But at the same time, if you look at a tree, it got, like, imperfections in it, too, and it's still, like, nice and stuff, so I'm just gonna be a tree.
And I have so much respect for Q.
I mean, I feel like part of the reason why, I mean, he's a dude, like you said, you know, he's your average music fan's never heard of him.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, any serious DJ.
Oh, yeah.
He's like an idol to them, right?
Oh, but, yeah, for sure.
But I also feel like part of the reason why he hasn't maybe, like, crossed over in the same way is because what he does is so hard.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's so...
It's not appreciated.
It's so advanced.
Yeah, it is. It's, like, literally he... I mean, and I know Q won't mind me talking about any of this stuff, but, I mean, he's a huge, like, believer in, like, you know... other dimensions and just like, I mean, he's
I've talked to him about that.
And I think for him, I just have so much respect for him being authentically him, you know, and he's not the guy who's like then gonna make a trap record with ASAP Rocky just for the sake of doing it, you know, for the sake of getting his name out there. And I have so much respect for this guy for that reason. At the same time, I find it also really fascinating. Like, Q has asked me on multiple occasions for, like, so give me a list of artists that, like, you know, that you're listening to. Like, you know, I want to know other things because he also, I think, recognizes that sometimes he can get a little bit wrapped up in his own bubble.
Yeah.
And, you know, he'll reach out on just like, yeah, so who's that producer? Like, who's this? Who's that? You know, I mean, he's just incredible, man.
That's cool.
I know with confidence that he will absolutely, his legacy will absolutely outlive him without a doubt.
For sure.
You know, it's just a matter of time.
All right. Well, let's talk about you though. So,
okay.
Do you remember your first gig?
Necessarily. I mean, I remember some, you know, so for me, it's been, I guess one of my more memorable first gigs was down here in LA at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And I brought that DJ in a box, Gemini DJ in a box down to LA with me with my two crates of records, half of which were my father's collection. And we were doing parties, you know, in the dorms at UCLA. I went to UCLA on a full scholarship, full academic scholarship. That's something that, you know, a lot of people don't know either.
That's huge.
And because of that, they
went to UCLA on academic probation. So I know I'm on the other side of that.
Oh man. I went to UCLA on this scholarship, which allowed me to have, apartment like dorm over at Hitch.
Yeah.
At UCLA. So they were like, you know, two bedroom apartments, six of us still in a two bedroom apartment. But I also had the opportunity because of my scholarship to kind of choose my roommates. Mm. So two of my roommates were friends of mine from high school, guys that I had grown up with in San Francisco. And we got into throwing parties in our dorm room. I don't even remember. Man, we were never into that, like, in high school. But, like, man, when we got to college, I guess it was just, like, wheels off, man. And
That's why you had academic scholarship, because you weren't
true.
In
and then, yeah, and then, yeah, as soon as I got to UCLA, I went crazy. But we were throwing parties in this little two-bedroom apartment, and was setting up, like, you know, I set up all my gear. At some point, man, one night we had about 200 people.
Yeah.
Like, packed into this, like,
man, I lived in one of those suites. They were not big. No.
They were not big. I mean, we put all the furniture outside.
Right.
And packed it in, had a keg in the shower, like, you know, full on, like, your full on college party. And to me, those were some of my first big gigs.
But you weren't getting going. You weren't thinking this as a career.
Oh, no. I was really interested in advertising, and UCLA didn't have an advertising major. Mm-hmm. And so I had to kind of get creative with how I went about, like, learning about that. I ended up interning at an advertising agency, small agency, boutique down in Manhattan Beach called K2. Okay. It was founded by Bob Kresser. Bob Kresser spent many years over at Ogilvy as, like, a big, you know, head honcho over at Ogilvy, and then stepped out on his own to start Kresser and Kresser. It was him and his son. Mm-hmm. Small firm, man. It was like 10 people. and the one of their big accounts they had was IMAX. Mm. You know, when IMAX was educational, prior to it being real commercial. So the first thing that I worked on that project was California Adventure.
Okay.
Which was a docu film on IMAX before it was, you know, at Disney.
Oh, fun.
Or all of that. Yeah. So that was what we had worked on. And I was almost certain that I was gonna try and get into advertising.
What did you want to do in advertising?
You know, I had I wanted to do something on the creative side. Mm-hmm. Like I felt like I had a bit of a passion for that. And when I ended up at Kresser, it was interesting because I got thrown into the media buying side, which for anybody who's out there that knows anything about advertising, that's the most boring part of advertising. I mean, that's like, you know, spreadsheets, and I mean, it might as well be like a finance job, you know. Right. And so I was interning for the head media buyer over there, who, you know, essentially, I mean, this was such a small firm. I was basically like her assistant, but her intern. So getting paid peanuts,
of course,
you know, to basically be her assistant. And then all of a sudden, one day she up and leaves in the middle of us, like, going through this campaign for IMAX. Mm-hmm. Like, right before we're about to, like, launch this campaign, she leaves. So the only person that actually knows what's going on about this stuff is me. And here I am, 19 years old, kind of thrown into this role. And at that point, I was just like, yeah, this is definitely what I don't want to do. but yeah, you know, I had a lot of, I kind of didn't know exactly what I wanted to do beyond that. I also, you know, UCLA had an advertising team that was like an extracurricular thing that you could participate in. And, you know, that was a great sort of organization for me to be a part of. I learned a lot about the creative end of the advertising business through that as well, and that kind of helped me sort of figure out if this was something I did or didn't want to do. But yeah, DJing full time was never an option necessarily in my head until I ended up joining this DJ company, this like mobile DJ company called Exquisite Sounds, when I was at school at UCLA. And I found these guys, they were DJing in the quad one day, and, like, you know, kind of made friends and whatnot. And, you know, I was like the 10th man on the 10 man, you know, crew.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of setting up speakers, a lot of setting up lighting and doing all that kind of stuff. And then you'd set all this gear up, and then you'd sit there and you'd watch. And you'd watch the older guys get on and play these gigs. And I remember, like, out of the 10-man crew, nobody really wanted to jump on a microphone. Mm. And so at some point, you know, in the night, there were things that just kind of needed to be said, you know, announcements that needed to be said, or like, you know, a costume contest that needed to be run, you know, slutty costume contest for Halloween or whatever. And nobody wanted to do it. I was like, okay, I'll do it, you know. And so that actually gave me a bit of a role in that. And by doing that, I actually learned that I really like that. Like, I really like being able to interact with a crowd in that way and use myself and my voice as an instrument and as a skill. So, you know, all of that actually really got me more interested and gave me more value for sure within our crew, gave me more value when it came to DJing, helped me kind of see that there was more to DJing than just that. And yeah, that, you know, sort of to make a long story short, some of these things are what really led me down this path of then being on KTLA on the morning news, you know, being a bit more extroverted when it came to this. Because as you know, by nature, I mean, we just talked about Q. I mean, Q is a fantastic person and is not necessarily an introverted person, but can have introverted moments. And tends to talk with his hands and with his craft more than with his mouth necessarily. Sure. So
yeah, and I think that's pretty common, at least maybe until this current era of DJing. Like,
for sure,
you could kind of be. It was a good job for people that didn't want to be in the spotlight.
Yeah, I mean, like, most of us got into it for that
hidden
reason.
In the booth. You know, you can see them, but they can't see you.
Right, in the shadows.
You don't have to talk.
Right. And even still to this day, I mean, we get quite a few people who come to Scratch and who want to pursue this, and you know, you go around the room and it's like, well, what got you into this? Well, you know, I didn't want to rap, I didn't want to, you know, be in front of the camera, and that's why I wanted to DJ. But yeah, that definitely is obviously changing with the current landscape now. But yeah, man, I at some point I didn't necessarily pursue DJ. I've never actually made a decision to pursue DJing full time. There's never been a moment in which I've actually decided
You're still thinking about it.
Yeah, I'm still thinking. I mean, like, it certainly is a bulk of my income, you know, at the end of the day. But it's something that, you know, I've been blessed and fortunate enough to be able to find other opportunities within the DJ world that then can provide, you know, some stability and also some joy and kind of like tick those other boxes for me. So, you know, we started actually within the crew. One of the guys that was in my crew, Brian, there's two Brians in this story, but Brian and Brian were both fraternity brothers, and they had gone down this path of starting a company called DJ City.
Okay.
And at the time we were just...
That was gear.
Yeah, we were just selling really records more than anything, like on an eBay store. the other Brian, who wasn't necessarily in our DJ crew, was a computer dude and just like genius when it came to that, knew how to code and built a website. And in 99, 2000, if you had that ability, you were freaking, you were golden, man. So, lucky for us, we had him in our, it wasn't even a company yet. I mean, we had him in our circle and he built that out and built a website and sort of fairly overnight, like it turned into something pretty successful, you know, based on the fact that there weren't a lot of competitors out there for anything like that. And then I came on board to really help with distribution, and I started a company, sort of a separate company that was a sister company of ours, distributing some of these vinyl records. So like a lot of the a lot of the DJ friendly records, you know, like the Fat Waxes, Lethal Weapons, Mixed Factors, a lot of those records. The guys at Strictly Hits up in Northern California were making Lethal Weapon, Mixed Factor.
Are those like Battle Tools, or those are like
It was a combination. You know, it's funny because now it's just so funny how this stuff is like come back around and become real, real necessary. But, you know, back then what it was, I mean, it was highly illegal. You know, taking six tracks, six hot records, or, you know, whatever, you know, six fairly hot records, creating intro versions of them, like 8-bar instrumental versions of them, so that they were easier for DJs to mix in and out of. And then also, like, you know, putting them on a record that then was like six for the price of two type of a thing, you know, like selling these records for like $12.99 retail versus it being $5.99 for a single, you know. So there'd definitely be value for DJs that were out there. And then also it allowed for somebody to you know, not have to worry about losing the records, or, you know, you're not losing the original 12 inch. You're not, you know, worried about scratching it up. Now you got like a compilation, and, you know, put hot girls on the labels and stuff like that. And you know, like, you're selling them. And I got into distributing those records and working with Kevin Scott, who then started DMS.
He's been on the show.
cool. So, yeah. You know, we were actually, I was Kevin's first distributor for his records. And yeah, man, we were, my job essentially was cold calling record stores and trying to get them to buy the records. Mm-hmm. And at some point we were running, all this entire operation out of a two bedroom apartment in West LA, right on Ohio and Barrington. And we had records everywhere. At sort of the height of that, we were, you know, sending out 200 packages retail, and probably like a day, and probably sending out like 10,000 records on the distro side every week, you know. And like at that point, then that's where we got our warehouse space in West LA, which is still the home of Scratch DJ Academy. And you know, we started running DJ City Urban Distribution and then Rehab Records out of that space. Which then later turned into Scratch DJ Academy, you know, something for the community.
Yo, if you're liking this one, we have some great stuff back in the Rebel Radio archives. Check out my interview with AJ Burtonshaw, the founder of Serato, Scratch Live. He's got some great DJ stories, just like we're hearing right now. Check that out. And right now, check out the rest of my interview with DJ Hoppa.
It's been an interesting ride, man.
Yeah.
I mean, and there's so many layers to all of these things, man. And I look back on like what we've done, and just to go back to what, you know, what you had asked me even at the start of this, of like, you know, making that decision to even DJ full time. It's like I made the decision to be in the DJ industry full time. You know, and I think that that's the decision that I've made more than anything. And I think all of these different aspects of it, though, allow. You know, one hand washes the other. I think, like, me being a DJ helps me be a better executive for Scratch DJ Academy. Helps me be a better, you know, helps me stay involved in the community. Yet at the same time, having something unique to offer to our community helps me, you know, be a better asset to others in our community.
So I want to talk about that for a minute because... So I want, you know, I want to get into the Scratch story a little bit, but, you know, I find it interesting that, like, you know, it's like any school, you have the business side, you have the academic side,
Or
the education side, or any creative business,
right?
If you run a record label, you have the creative side, you have the business side.
Yeah.
And I think, so I wonder what you think, how important is it that the people running the business side understand what it means to be a DJ?
So it's really interesting because, you know, currently, and it's been this way for years, it's funny, our CEO for Scratch is Rob Principe, who's a mentor of mine, great dude, amazing entrepreneur, and somebody that, like, I really admire his entrepreneurial spirit. I mean, real quick, you know, people may not know this, but Scratch DJ Academy was founded in 2002 by Rob and Jam Master Jay. There was another guy at the time, too, Reggie Gaines, who really was a writer, author, and helped write a lot of the original curriculum and gave it more of an educational slant.
Yeah.
Rob brought the business, Reggie brought the education side, and Jay obviously brought the creative and the wow factor, right? and the vision. And so... you know, they start this school in 2002 in New York City, and literally later that year, Jam Master Jay is murdered. And just even to get inside of Rob's head, we've had multiple conversations about this, because for me as an entrepreneur, I don't know what that would do for me if I had started this business with somebody who, like, let's say I started a wellness company with Jillian Michaels or something like that, and all of a sudden Jillian Michaels isn't there anymore. And, like, I've got this wellness company, and you know, what do I know about wellness? Like, she's the one who's,
because,
like,
Rob's
pushing
not
this.
A DJ.
Rob's not a DJ. Right. No, no, not at all. And, like, you know, I think about that, and the way in which we lost Jay, you know, the way in which the world lost Jay, the fact that the murder is still not even solved, you know. I mean, he even told me, I mean, he was on a suspect list. You know, the FBI were questioning him. I mean, they had just started this business.
Sure.
So, I mean, like, you know, I mean, and for him to have the perseverance to keep going with this and to, you know, forge forward, I got so much respect for him. But yeah, I think on that side, you know, Rob often describes me or talks about me in the way of in which he calls it that I'm bilingual, you know, that I'm able to sort of speak the language of business and be able to hold a conversation on that side, and that I understand the principles of business. By no means am I an expert in, you know, business as a whole, but I certainly am an expert in what our business is and what we do. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, like, I certainly do also have the creative language down. So to me, honestly, I feel like, you know, not to boast or anything, but I feel like my position in our company is an important one. I feel like I'm a translator a lot of times, mm-hmm. In taking, you know, some of the stuff that, you know, some of my instructors on the ground in any of our cities who are maybe more creative and less business focused, mm-hmm. To be able to translate our message and what we're trying to achieve on the business side, or why we're changing the curriculum to be this, or, you know, why we've moved to this higher price point or whatnot, mm-hmm. and to explain to them that this isn't about, you know, greed or this and that. And then at the same time, to be able to go back to, like, you know, a guy like Rob or, you know, some of the other guys that we have at the academy and say, you know, guys, we got to switch this up, and this is what's going on in the industry, and this is what this is. And yeah. I know, because my ears to the street. I mean, I'm living and breathing this thing, so that they're not making decisions in ivory towers, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, like, my job essentially is this, like, you know, this messenger who's got the keys to the ivory tower and can get inside there and, you know, have access to the 17th right. floor.
Sure.
Yet at the same time, like, have access to the street and have access to, you know, everything on the ground. And I think, like, more than anything, I don't think it's absolutely necessary for, like, if Rob were a DJ, or if he taught himself how to DJ, or, like, it still wouldn't be authentic to who he is. Right. Like, he's a business guy. He's an entrepreneur. And, like, I think that there's something really great about him being able to think in that space and be able to move our company forward. I think that, you know, without him at the helm, mm-hmm. I don't know if Scratch DJ Academy and Scratch Music Group as a whole would be where it's at. You know, certainly not. And no knock to Jay, but, you know, if it were the other way around and we lost Rob mm-hmm. instead of Jay,
right.
It would be a different story.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if we would be here,
sure.
you know, to be honest with you. And so I think that it's good to have people within an organization that, you know, have those different skill sets. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's good for you to have somebody in an organization like myself who's able to, like, you know, walk that line. And I think you're able to do the same as well, you know. And I think I'm not unique in that sense. I think that there's quite a few of us that are able to be bilingual.
Yeah, but I think it's an interesting role, right? And as you said, it creates a ton of opportunity. And I think, you know, it puts you in a position to add a lot of value.
Mm-hmm.
It also creates, I think, a tremendous pressure because, you know, you're not solely focused on making money or on right. doing cool stuff or on, right?
Right.
You're seeing the trade-offs that each thing we do over here has an impact over here.
Yeah.
And they're not always...
Oh yeah, there's
moving
been some
forward at the same pace.
Dude, there's been some sleepless nights for sure. You know, I mean, there's times where I feel like, you know, and I do my best to try and be as vocal as possible and to try and be as honest as possible with, like, you know, how I feel about this decision or that
right.
decision. I mean, there's been some decisions, you know, over the course of time that I haven't been happy with and haven't been pleased with, on both ends of that. You know, decisions that creatives have made that I haven't been on board with, that I felt like have hurt our company. And then also decisions that, you know, people in offices have made that I felt like haven't been the right decisions, you know.
Yeah.
And I think at the end of the day, I'm, you know, it's this ebb and flow. And, you know, I try myself to sort of look at it from the sort of more macro perspective and to try not to get too, you know, bogged down by some of these, like, isolated events or, you know, these isolated occurrences, because it absolutely is much larger than that. It's certainly a marathon versus a sprint. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's going to be some of these battles that we win, or that I personally win, or, you know, that we as a company win, mm-hmm. And some that we lose, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, like, overall, though, I mean, for me, it's taken some time to, like, really understand that and learn that and be able to digest that part of it. of not getting too, you know, caught up in like this one battle over 599 versus 549, and in the past, I've been, those were the times where I've like lost sleep over that, you know, and been like, ah, it's 599, just, ah, they just don't get it, you know, or like,
right.
At the end of the day, man, I think you just kind of learn to take a step back and to sort of look at, you know, it in a bigger way.
Yeah.
You
know? Yo, that was the end of part one with DJ Hop on Rebel Radio. Make sure you come back for part two. He's going to drop a bomb on us, something you are definitely not expecting. I don't mean to leave you with a cliffhanger, but I'm going to leave you with a cliffhanger because some great stories coming up next week from DJ Hop on Rebel Radio. Make sure you hit us on Twitter at Rebel Radio Net. Find us on YouTube for some of these interviews on video. And go ahead and leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. You're a Christmas present to us. Peace.